Well, welcome to another episode of All Movie Talk. I'm Stephen Keller.
I'm Sam Stoddard. So we have a very unified theme for this week's episode, right? What's that theme?
The theme is no theme.
The theme is no theme.
Yeah.
Every one of the topics we're going to be talking about this episode has no theme at all.
Well, maybe they have internal themes, but I guess so. Then the theme is just internal themes.
Internal themes.
Yes. Yeah, so. To the topics.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Sam.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Now, what I have just done is demonstrated most of the dialogue in The Room, which we talked about in our first special episode of All Movie Talk, and since that time, I've seen the movie, so I just wanted to add, oh my goodness, what is that?
I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, really half the movie's dialogue consists of the main character saying hi to people. Probably the best is, at one point, as he's leaving a flower shop, he sees a dog. He says, oh, hi, doggy. And that got put in the movie.
All right, so I don't have a lot to add to what we already talked about, except that I am convinced this is autobiographical. This really happened to him. Somebody broke up with him, and this is what he did because of that. In which case, you know, she was right to break up with him, obviously. But it's too bad that she had to do it, because then we had this. But I swear it's autobiographical, because, I mean, if you think about it, every character is defined in terms of the main character. Like, the girlfriend is the girlfriend, the best friend is the best friend, and he introduces himself as, I'm his best friend. And even, like, the girlfriend's mother only ever talks about him. I mean, this central character, Tommy, is the universe. You know, I mean, if you're a little kid, it's like, you know, well, if something happens to me, you'll be sorry. And that's more or less this movie. You know, at the end, the girlfriend is crushed and devastated by how horrible she's been, and that's the fantasy. If you've been through a bad breakup, you know, you're not in the frame of mind to understand the other person's perspective. You just kind of think that you're a victim, and you know, things have happened to you that are unjust, and you know, it reeks of that kind of immature temper tantrum that you have after a bad breakup. But he made it into a movie, and I kind of resent that.
You know, you say that characters are defined in terms of their relationship to the main character. That's where the characters are defined. No, I agree with you. Definitely, though, autobiographical. And I think it gives us a good peek into Tommy Wiseau's head in that nothing in it makes any kind of sense at all. I mean, so you get what I'm saying? Like half of the movie is just non sequiturs. It's stuff that...
Well, if it's stuff unrelated to him, like some lady has breast cancer, well, what's that got to do with how my girlfriend is being mean to me?
True.
It's a wonder that line made it into the movie in the first place.
What about when they play football in tuxedos? And by playing football, I mean stand 2 feet from each other and toss the ball underhanded.
Well, he was in that scene, so it's just...
My personal feeling is like it's his imitation of trying to pretend to be an American, which is, well, these Americans love to throw football, so we'll go throw football. And not really clear on exactly how football works, that nobody does that.
All right, so if I can be serious for a minute, if you're a budding writer, a screenwriter or a novelist or anything, and you want to know how to create convincing characters, I will give you just the best advice anybody ever could, and the advice that Tommy Wiseau just either never got or ignored, and that is every character is the main character in his own mind, okay? You want to create a convincing co-star, you don't have him be a co-star. He's not a sidekick. He doesn't go around introducing himself as, I'm this guy's sidekick, or I'm this guy's dad, or I'm this, you know, he's the hero in his own mind. So if you use that approach to all your characters, whether they're major or minor, then you will have a more convincing story than The Room.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe occasionally allow some of them to have different speech patterns and not just all say, oh, hi, to every person they meet.
Oh, hi. Let's have a change of topic, speaking of non sequiturs.
Okay, well, actually, this is somewhat related.
Oh.
Let's talk about riff tracks.
Ooh.
Which I really like. And hey, there's riff tracks of The Room, which is the only way to make it even remotely tolerable. So, basic premise of riff tracks, I think probably most of our listeners are familiar with Mystery Science Theater 3000, and if you're not, it was an American cable TV show, 90s and I think early 2000s, and it featured a sort of changing cast of people, depending on which season you watched, watching really terrible movies and then making fun of them, and you know, very famous because you saw their silhouettes in front of the movie screens. It was a guy and these two robot puppet things. And it was just really, if you are the kind of people who like watching bad movies and making fun of them, then Mystery Science Theater was great because it, you know, did the making fun of it for you. So it was a good way to watch bad movies. Anyway, that show got canceled eventually. You know, big surprise that a show about people making fun of terrible movies just couldn't quite last.
Oh, no. The big surprise is that it went 10 years and a feature film. I mean, that's amazing.
That is pretty
amazing. Especially since the first two or three seasons weren't that great. The first one, definitely, before it made it to Comedy Central. I don't understand why it was as popular as it was. As the show got on, it just kept getting better and better and better. And even like the last season, you know, a lot of shows are wearing out. This one wasn't. It's too bad that it had to go. But the people who were making Mystery Science Theater didn't stop.
Yeah, so there are, I guess, sort of two, I don't know if they're competing companies, but companies made up of two different groups of writers and actors from the show, one of which is called Riff Tracks, which I think is probably, it's been around longer, so maybe it just seems more successful. There is called Cinematic Titanic, and what these are basically for people who like Mystery Science Theater and want more of it, here's a way to keep doing it. So what we'll talk about maybe Cinematic Titanic first because it's a little easier. It's basically what Mystery Science Theater was. You spend $15 or whatever, and you get yourself a DVD, and it's some awful movie you've never heard of, and it's got silhouettes of people making fun of it. And that's sort of led by Joel Hodgson, who was the creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000, though he actually left the show about halfway through its run.
And there's four other people involved with it, too, who are also from the show. So if you like those voices and those performers, then you can get more of it by checking out these Cinematic Titanic DVDs.
Yeah. And if you want a little bit of a different take, you can check out Riff Tracks, which I think has way more content so far. Again, they've been around for a couple of years now. And this is the brainchild of Mike Nelson, who was the guy who kind of replaced Joel. So I guess it makes sense that they each have their own thing going on. And Mike Nelson is basically taking the idea of, instead of distributing the movies, because part of the problem with Mystery Science Theater was they had to have the rights to show the movies, and same thing with Cinematic Titanic. You know, if you want to make fun of Batman and Robin, you really kind of can't, because Warner Brothers would never in a million years let you just sell a Batman and Robin DVD that had you making fun of it. Though it would actually probably sell more copies than the actual Batman and Robin DVD, so they should really consider it. So what they said is, well, you know, hey, look, we're just going to sell audio files, so for $3 you can download an MP3 of Mike Nelson and his other various people making fun of all kinds of popular movies as well as some more obscure bad movies. So, for instance, if you want to see him making fun of Batman and Robin or The Room, you spend your $4, you download your MP3, and then it's a little bit of a pain because you have to sync the movie and the audio, and they got some software to do it, but it never seems to work quite right. But anyway, I end up just like having an iPod connected to a pair of speakers sitting in my living room while I watch the DVD of the movie on my TV and just kind of ghetto, but it works. And it's very, very funny. And it's cool seeing people make fun of, you know, big budget bad movies that I've hated for a long time. They've got Battlefield Earth. They've got the Spider-Man movies, which is wonderful for me because I hate those movies and everyone else loves them. And then they also make fun of movies that they actually like. So they've got all six of the Star Wars movies. They've got the Lord of the Rings movies, a bunch of the Harry Potter movies.
So you're making the point that The Room is actually an exception. The Room would be the kind of movie that they might feature in Mystery Science Theater or in Cinematic Titanic.
Right.
They did that one because it has such a high profile and is a current film. So, but normally what they do is the big action movies, you know, 300, I think, was one of them, too.
Yeah, they do a lot of, like, older shorts, like Mystery Science Theater used to always do. Those, you actually just download the movie and the audio sync together, because those, like, they're in the public domain. You know, there's no copyright issues.
Yeah. So if you're familiar with Mystery Science Theater and you want to know who we're talking about, the people who do Riff Tracks would be Mike Nelson and Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett. And those three actually got onto Riff Tracks because a previous project didn't make it. It was called The Film Crew. And the premise of that was that there was these three guys who were hired to provide DVD commentaries for movies that didn't have them. In reality, the commentary that they provided would be the riffing that we're familiar with. But they did four of those that are released on DVD, and you can get those, and those are pretty good. I've seen three of the four, and they're very funny. But then the distributor of the Film Crew was also the distributor of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 TV show, and the producer of that was like, oh, wait a minute, these projects are too similar, you have to pick one. And so the distributor said, well, okay, we'll pick the one that people know about. And so that left Mike and Kevin and Bill kind of stranded, so eventually they wound up on Riff Tracks, which is probably a good thing.
Well, the cool thing, though, about Riff Tracks is they also have non-Mystery Science Theater people sometimes doing riffing. Weird Al Yankovic does one with Mike on Jurassic Park, I think. There's some other celebrities. I think the guy from Something Awful is on one. Low Tax, I think he does one.
Yeah.
Kind of weird, and it's fun. And I kind of like Riff Tracks because I kind of like these big budget movies getting skewered, which is sometimes a lot of fun.
It is, but I'm still waiting for somebody to do Sinbad on the Seven Seas because I just can't get enough of that one.
I think so. And actually kind of interesting, the Riff Tracks has, I haven't really listened to much of these, this whole kind of community thing where if you want to try making fun of bad movies, they have a place where you can post your MP3s and get publicity, and they've actually, I think, hired some of the people who have done those to do like actual riff tracks.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
It is, and yeah, very funny. And you know, for $3 and the cost of renting some crappy movie, you get a pretty good time.
So let's take another non sequitur here and talk about a movie called High and Low, which is Akira Kurosawa. He made it in 1963, and you know, I don't have a lot to say about this except that when I was watching it recently, it struck me that this might be the first forensic mystery. Basically, this kid is kidnapped, and it is thought to be this child of a really rich guy, and so the ransom call comes in, but then it turns out they have the wrong kid, and so this very rich person has a moral dilemma. You know, this is a kid that is not his own. Does he want to pay the ransom because the kid's real parents don't have any money? So, you know, is he morally obligated to shell out the money for this? And so there's an interesting moral question there. But then while all this is happening, the police are organizing a search to try to find the kid in the first place. And long stretches of this feel like an episode of CSI. This is CSI Tokyo, I guess. Very interested because I haven't really been aware, other than with this movie, of the like forensic science being the basis of a major movie until very recently.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't think of any earlier examples, so maybe it is the first forensic procedural. How does it compare to every drama on CBS?
Oh, much better. Yeah.
Shocking. All right. Well, we can switch topics. I was thinking of something a little earlier, which is that 2009 may be a great year for horror movies for two reasons. One, Saw 6 kind of bombed at the box office, made like half of what other movies have made, is there such a thing as like an anti-fan? If you can be a fan of something, can you be an anti-fan or maybe just a hater? I don't know.
I think you can, because the internet is full of them.
Good point.
For every topic.
Well, I try not to be that guy, but I am that guy with the Saw movies, which I really don't like at all. And to me, it's like dirty, brown, rusty-looking movies that have kind of taken over horror in the last, well, since the first Saw movie and Hostel made all that money, I really dislike. So, hey, it was nice seeing that Saw may hopefully someday be headed for direct-to-DVD. Though I have to admit, I was kind of amazed they managed to make 6 of those in 6 years and all went straight to the theater. That's completely unprecedented in this day and age.
What's also weird is that they never introduced a subtitle along the way. Usually around number 3 or 4, it's like, oh no, it's Saw 4, The Revenge.
Yeah, and I will give them credit. Like, it's interesting in a horror series that's gone on for 6 episodes that it has sort of one long running, super complicated plot, which may be why Saw 6. I think like if you haven't paid very close attention to them, there's no way to understand what's going on. So, anyway, that's those movies, and maybe hopefully it'll be the end of them, and maybe we can get to a more interesting place in horror. The big horror movie of the year has been Paranormal Activity, which is a really fun movie. I thought it was pretty effective. Seems like it's certainly got its anti-fans. Guys who like the Saw movie sort of hate this movie. But obviously it's been a really huge success. The movie was made for very little money, and it's sort of a Blair Witch kind of thing. Where, by the way, have we talked about the Blair Witch much, Sam? How do you feel about that movie?
I thought it was a fascinating experiment, but as a movie, you know, it's effective, but I'd never want to watch it again. I'm kind of on the fence on that one.
Sure. You think it scary at all?
Yeah, the first time.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. I mean, like anything, it depends on the environment. If it's in the daylight and you have some friends over and you're kind of, you know,
right,
in a lighthearted mood and you don't mind making fun of it, it's going to be completely lost on you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're focused, if you don't have any outside distractions and you just immerse yourself in it, then it's going to make all the difference. And I think when people say, oh, this is the scariest movie ever, and it's like, oh, that wasn't scary. I think a lot of the time, that's what's different.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, without giving it away, did the final scene in the Blair Witch work for you? Did that kind of creep you out a little bit?
Yeah, it was.
I always thought that was really effective.
Yeah.
So if that worked for you, I think Paranormal Activity will work for you, because it's the same kind of horror of stuff that's maybe not overtly scary. And the basic setup, if somehow you've avoided hearing about it, basically just really two characters in the movie, this guy and this girl who are living together, and they've started hearing weird sounds at night, and the girl reveals, oh, ever since she's been a kid, there have been these weird occurrences around her. So the guy decides, hey, I'm going to buy myself this fancy video camera, and I'm going to just set it up, and it's going to record all night long while we sleep. And so it's one of those kind of things where, like Cloverfield or Blair Witch, the character is always shooting the camera, or else it's on a tripod. And so it's always that kind of handheld shot without many cuts. And large stretches of the movie are just them sleeping as we kind of go through some time-lapse stuff, and then, you know, it'll stop during the time-lapse at like 3 in the morning for something creepy to happen. And it starts off small, like, you know, a door moves on its own. And then, I don't want to ruin it, but stuff gets progressively weirder and weirder. But it's never the big scares that you might expect it to be. This is a horror movie without any cat scares, which is nice. No leaping cats freaking you out. In fact, no real shock sting moments at all. I don't think there's any score whatsoever, which is kind of refreshing. Also, in a horror movie, it doesn't rely on that. It just has to rely on this building sense of terror and dread and really deeply unsettling stuff, which is very effective. And really, you know, I don't want to spoil too much, but it doesn't go the places that you think a horror movie would go. I've talked with some friends of mine about it too, and it's like, okay, well, during this scene, I thought for sure, all right, well, this is where the thing was going to jump out at him, but it constantly refused to do that. And I think because of that, it doesn't break the tension that it builds up. Like, if you watch a slasher flick, there's repeated build-up, crescendo, all right, release, tension moments, whereas Paranormal Activity never, ever, up until the climax of the film, it never releases the tension. It never gives you that, there you go, all right, now you can go. There's sort of this cathartic moment, now let's relax again for a little while. There's none of that, which, boy, is it on edge. Though, you know, it's funny you mentioned the environment to watch a movie in. I watched this in the theater, and about halfway through the movie, a group of like 8 teenagers got kicked out for like shouting. And
wow.
Just, so good. Well, they didn't go quietly into that good night. Oh. So it was like a 5-minute complete and total distraction from the movie.
Oh.
They were not, by the way. They were, in fact, in that lighthearted Sunday afternoon, let's make fun of a movie kind of mode. So I don't think it was working for them. Just going back to our old, you know, movie theater versus comfort of your own home experience, man, I kind of wish I'd watched that in the comfort of my own home. So I could have just seen it quietly, because it's a very quiet movie that relies on silence.
Yeah, horror movies more than anything rely on the conditions that you watch it in. So, again, total 180 turn here. I want to talk about a movie called Scenes from a Marriage, which is by the Swedish director Ingmar Bergman, who in 1973, I think, made a very long movie for TV, actually, and there's a theatrical cut that's about half the length, and it is literally just what the title says, Scenes from a Marriage. It doesn't sound that exciting. It was very compelling to me. It was a character study. If you're not into character studies, then, you know, I'm not saying everybody would be interested in this movie, but as a character study and as a story of a marriage progressing through various phases, this was fascinating. And it actually does build up a lot of emotion, too. There are some scenes that are very tense. But most of all, it's just an observation of life. One of the things, though, that interested me about it is that, as I say, the movie is a series of scenes from a marriage, and they're separated in time, particularly. But you're not necessarily given that cue. You have to figure out that a lot of time may have elapsed since the previous scene. And because that was a little bit jarring, it made me think about how movies are structured normally. Normally, you have a movie that's edited together. If there is a time lapse, you can assume that nothing of significance has happened because, hey, we're skipping this amount of time because it doesn't matter. Now we'll get to the next part in our story. Well, this movie is not quite like that. It's trying to tell the story of a marriage which lasts years long, and it's trying to do that in a relatively short period of time. So you have a scene maybe where they fight and they get mad at each other, and then the next scene, well, wait a minute, they're not mad, and you didn't resolve that thing that you were talking about. What's the deal? And as the scene unfolds, you realize, oh, okay, well, some time has passed, and yes, it does make sense. In real life, this is how it would be. Even if you haven't resolved that issue, you're not going to be still steamed about it as if it had just happened 3 years later. An interesting way to structure a movie, and I think that actually made it all the more compelling because it was just that much more realistic about how life is.
Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting. I haven't seen it, but you make me really want to see it. I've read about it before. But
I should footnote here. He made a follow-up movie, his last movie in 2006 before he died, was Saraband, which I'm probably not pronouncing right, but that was a sequel of sorts, and it reunites the same two actors and just chronicles a little bit of those characters' lives later on.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I like those kinds of movies quite a bit. Let's see here. You know, we could talk about Blade Runner, because, you know, what is an all-movie talk without me talking about Blade Runner?
Not an all-movie talk at all.
Since we did the podcast, since we stopped doing it, they released the ultimate, super, uber, hopefully last version of Blade Runner, which I think Ridley Scott called the final cut, and I guess he himself did not actually have a lot of participation in the director's cut that we all saw that came out in the early 90s on VHS. What happened was, you know, they reassembled what he wanted. But he himself wasn't there too much, I guess. So he came back and did the final cut, which is a very interesting example of how you can use CGI for good and not for evil. And George Lucas should take some notes, because he went back and cleaned some stuff up. That was a little. There's a couple of weird little continuity errors in the original movie, or things that don't quite look that good, and they very subtly cleaned it up for the final cut, which is kind of nice, and a couple other little changes that you have to be a crazy Blade Runner fan to notice, really, if you want to. It gives us even more fodder for the is Deckard a replicant argument or not.
So that's interesting, and I'm okay with that happening as long as the original version remains available.
Well, that's the cool thing.
So you don't erase or rewrite history.
I'm with you there. So there's like four different versions of the DVDs that came out. So you can get basically the ultimate collector set that has the original theatrical cut, the original international theatrical cut, the work print cut, which was like this fabled thing that, you know, I read about on the internet and never been able to see before, which was this basically what they showed to test audiences before the theatrical cut, and then the original VHS director's cut, and now also the final cut. So it's actually five different versions of the film, which are all pretty similar, really. And yeah, unlike, say, George Lucas trying his best to, you know, when he finally put the original theatrical, kind of theatrical Star Wars movies out on DVD, he, you know, did no work to clean them up. All five versions of the movie look really good. They're in high def and look fantastic. It's so nice to get that. I just wish I could get something like that for the Star Wars films. The amount of money that I would spend on a Star Wars Blu-ray set that had every version ever all cleaned up and looking good is ridiculous. And, you know, like, once again, George Lucas should take my money. But yeah, I mean, if you remember, like, they just all the annoying CGI stuff that George Lucas threw into, like, you know, Tatooine or Mos Eisley in A New Hope, in the special edition of that, and just how really wrong and bad it was. I think Ridley Scott showing, no, we can use some CGI, we can go and touch some stuff up, and just fix little mistakes or make things kind of, you know, when George Lucas claims that the special edition represents his original vision. Like, did your original vision really involve cartoon aliens flying around Mos Eisley? Really? Like, I don't believe him. When Ridley Scott says this cut represents what he actually wanted to do, I do believe him. It does seem pretty close and good, well worth checking out if you're, I think I've made the argument for Blade Runner being one of the best science fiction movies ever many times before, but yeah, you can't go wrong with getting the five-disc set.
So I've got a topic that actually relates to what you just said, because one of the creative influences of Blade Runner would be the silent film Metropolis, which is sort of the first movie that had this overcrowded, really expressionistic, huge city. Metropolis was so influential if you haven't heard of it, you've seen the influence of it without realizing it. And Blade Runner is one of those movies that is pretty directly descended, at least in terms of the visual style. And for that matter, the replicants, I mean, there are, you know, some form of replicant type characters in Metropolis. There's a lot going on. There's the oppressive totalitarian regime. There's, as I say, the huge cityscapes. And this is just a great science fiction movie as well. Well, the reason I'm bringing it up now is because within the last couple of years, they unearthed an uncut print of Metropolis. Previously, the longest versions we've had have run about 2 hours, maybe a little bit more. This one runs 210 minutes. So almost twice the length. And it was found in Brazil somewhere. And it was a rather amazing discovery because a lot of people like this movie. A lot of people who are not necessarily film aficionados understand and recognize the entertainment value of this movie. So it was great that they found it. And I guess it's being cleaned up now and is scheduled to be completed by next year, maybe. We'll maybe even have a DVD next year.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's very exciting news, because normally if a film is lost, and especially if it's a classic that people have probably been looking for, you know, they don't tend to turn up anymore.
It is always fun when they do turn up. I think, and I both just love these stories of movies, like The Rules of the Game showing up somewhere in a closet in a mental hospital or something. Love those stories of them finding films. I'm definitely excited for this new Metropolis. How much did they film, by the way? How do they even have a version that much longer?
I don't know.
And should we get our hopes up for the sort of holy grails of missing film footage, the long-form version of Greed or the missing reel from Magnificent Ambersons? Any chance we ever find those?
Yeah, those are... I'm not so sure about those.
I guess it's different when the studio deliberately destroys the footage.
As opposed to just accidentally lost it, right?
Yeah, but wow. It's mind-boggling. Like, could you imagine that happening today? Like, someone goes out and shoots, like, you know, puts together and edits a five-hour movie, and then somehow we just lose half of it or something? Like,
well, it just goes to show how perspective has changed on film. Back in the 20s, and if you go to our website, allmovietalk.com, I run a series of posts there called The Vintage Posts. I mean, well, I did run it. I actually posted one fairly recently, and I may do more, I'm not sure, but they're all about what the industry was like in the late 1920s and kind of what social perspectives there were, what the technology was like and what the attitudes were, what it was like to go to the movies, that sort of thing. It is very clear that people didn't see movies as an art that should be preserved. They were a transient entertainment, more or less like plays are. You know, live performances of shows and stuff, well, they're not preserved forever, so, you know, they weren't really thinking about movies being preservable.
Right.
And so they didn't really do it. In fact, you know, when the studios kind of were running low on cash, they just melt down whole libraries of their movies for the silver content in the film. It's estimated that 90% of silent film is lost today. So, yeah, that wouldn't happen today, fortunately, because people are just so interested in having records of movies, and studios are seeing the monetary value in it, too. So there's even some incentive there to keep these things around.
Yeah, well, wow, that sounds like a segue, like we had planned it or something.
Oh.
You want to talk about, you know, exploiting your studio library for value.
I did sort of lead into that. Yeah, another topic I wanted to talk about is, Warner Brothers. You are wonderful. You may have made some bad decisions with superhero franchises in the past, but Warner Brothers has done a wonderful thing. It's a great way to leverage new technology. They have something called the Warner Archive Project, and you can get to it online if you go to warnerarchive.com. And the idea of it is that, well, hey, here we have these thousands of movies in our library that don't have enough commercial value to release on DVD and, you know, make new artwork for, do the restoration for, get the special features and do the marketing and, you know, let the retail chains take their cuts out of it. I mean, it's just too expensive to release every movie, but they figured out a way to make movies available on demand. And what this is if you place an order with them directly, they have scanned a lot of their old archive titles digitally, and they have it on a hard drive somewhere. And if you want to order one of the movies, you go and ask for it, and they will do a custom print of a CD for you. They'll burn you a fresh CD and ship it to you. It does come with some artwork, in the box, just some minimal thing. And so, I guess I hear some of them actually have their theatrical trailers. But otherwise, you don't get any extras. You don't get any restoration work. And it is fairly expensive. I think for the most part, it's $20 a disc. But the point is, you can see these movies, whereas previously you just couldn't. And I was looking through the list of titles there. They have quite a lot now. They started it several months ago and have since then built up quite a library. But some of them are actually pretty interesting titles. One of them is the movie Hot Millions from the 60s. And if you have a really good memory, as I know at least one of our listeners does, he will remember that that was my number one pick in our top six computer movies list, the movie Hot Millions. It's a great movie. It's very funny. You can get it now. It was not previously available on DVD. Some historical movies are interesting too, like The Rain People, which is an early Francis Ford Coppola movie, or The Moon is Blue, which was made by Otto Preminger. And the reason that's significant is because it was one of the movies that broke down the Hays Code in the 60s and led to us having the MPAA ratings we have today, like, PG, PG-13, R. There's something about Otto Preminger. I think he single-handedly was on a mission to just shut the Hays Code down. And I also have to mention there's a lot of Tarzan movies you can get from there. So, and you can get those half price if you get them in bundles.
Tarzan bundles.
Does that sound like a good idea to you?
No. Well, I mean, buying Tarzan bundles sounds like a bad idea, but Warner offering the service is wonderful. Eventually, every studio should do this, and it should be both. Obviously, I hope someday you can download it or just buy the DVD. And the price, though, probably should come down to $20 is a little bit expensive.
Right, but if you get the Tarzan bundle, it's just $10 a disc.
Oh, okay, great. but the
I get the feeling you're not taking me seriously. The movie called Tarzan's Greatest Adventure actually might be. That is a really good movie. It's very suspenseful.
Okay.
And there's a lot of jungle running around.
I always think when you recommend jungle movies, I got to take it with like a couple grains of salt always.
Oh, come on.
I got to like perform the Sam jungle movie math.
All right. Well, I just want to see all the Jungle Jim movies. I haven't been able to locate them all, so I hope that with efforts like this, they can bring me Jungle Jim, and then it all have been worth it.
Yeah. And the awesome thing is Universal is sort of doing this too. They just did it over right before Halloween, working with Turner Classic Movies to offer a couple of their very obscure horror movies on, and they same kind of thing where they press them on demand. The price is the same, $20. They only have 5 titles right now, but if you buy them all together, that's only 50. So same kind of deal as the Tarzan bundles. And we're not talking here about the Wolfman or the Mummy. We're talking about the obscure Universal stuff like the Mad Doctor of Market Street, Murders in the Zoo, or The Strange Case of Dr. RX.
Those are great titles.
They are wonderful titles. And these are all early 40s movies, I think, yeah. Well, I guess Murders in the Zoo is 33. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you're a fan of classic horror, then this is probably a great thing for you. And they are definitely going to open up more of the catalog. And I hope that as we see more and more of this, I'm very interested in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think back before videotape, basically, you could see movies in the theater that were new. You could see re-releases of only the most popular things. And you had whatever they put on TV, which isn't even as much as they do today. And that was it. And you certainly couldn't watch a movie whenever you wanted to. So videotape comes along and people start dumping out their old titles onto videotape to fill video stores and everything. And that was just great. Suddenly, you could have access to a lot of movies that you couldn't before. But most movies never got a videotape release, never got a DVD release, either one. Some got a videotape release but aren't on DVD and therefore aren't available in any kind of permanent form. Videotapes do tend to wear out over time. And so now there is the possibility, if these things are successful, and apparently Warner Archive has been, I don't know how much, but apparently it's been successful enough that they're interested in keeping it going. The potential is to get everything that any of these studios have available to watch when you want to. I mean, that's amazing and great.
Yeah, maybe we can actually get The African Queen on DVD someday.
Yeah, maybe. So those obscure, not so much in demand titles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one's a rights issue. Apparently, no one knows exactly who owns the home video rights to that movie, but it is weird. Hey, there's a movie that's on the AFI Top 100 Films that you cannot get on DVD legally. Or, well, there's this gray copy that you can purchase, but anyway. Maybe just a couple of thoughts interesting about how we continue to access and use movies, because there's been so much of this in the last couple of years. Once again, sort of since we stopped doing the show, we had a format war, which ended. So if you didn't hear, Blu-ray beat out high-def DVD, which, you know, a small percentage of the population probably cares about. But given that I was one of the suckers who owns an HD DVD player.
Oh!
I bought my... It was so sad. It was like almost immediately after I bought my HD DVD player, the format war ended. So that was awesome. And then I went out and had to buy a Blu-ray player like the next day, which was great. So that's why you shouldn't be an early adopter. And I knew I was a sucker when I did it. So don't feel sorry for me. I'm just stupid. But also we have sort of an ongoing... I mean, the fact is that Blu-ray has been kind of successful, but not super successful. And it's been out for a couple of years now, and the catalog is still kind of weak. Pretty much all new theatrical movies that get released on DVD get a Blu-ray release as well. But the back library catalog is not great, and I don't really know how good it's going to get. I'm not sure. It actually seems like Blu-ray may not replace DVD ever. Like I actually think maybe Blu-ray just ends up staying a kind of niche market. Maybe better, but similar to how laser just existed, you know, parallel with VHS for a long time. Like everyone thinks of Laserdisc as being a huge failure, but in reality, Laserdisc was out for like, you know, 10 or 15 years or something. There were a ton of movies. It was never in everyone's house, but the companies that sold those players and the discs made a lot of money doing it, and, you know, it served people well who were in that. Blu-ray, I think, might just be the same kind of thing.
I can tell Sony how to fix their problem, though. If they want Blu-ray to catch on, I know how they can do it.
How's that?
Take the prices down just a little bit. They come out with these very expensive... I mean, if it costs more money to get a Blu-ray over a DVD, and you're not just really keyed into the improved picture quality, why would anybody care? Why would they go for the more expensive option if picture quality isn't, you know... And even if picture quality is important, if you don't have a high-def TV, then you don't get the benefit of Blu-ray. So
you can't watch Blu-ray on a standard def TV.
Yeah, you can't even watch it at all. So why is it more expensive? Take the cost of the players down from...
Yeah, the players are now pretty affordable. You can get budget Blu-ray players for $200 or less. So that's not too bad.
Yeah, but that's too little too late. It needs to come down a lot more than that. Sell the players at a loss so you get people on the format and you're making all kinds of money off the discs themselves and you'll be all set.
Yeah, the sad thing is Sony is apparently taking like a $200 loss on every PlayStation 3 they sell, which is obviously a Blu-ray player and one of the best Blu-ray players at that. But it's still $300 to buy it. So, and that's it just got its price reduced. Yeah, I think the real problem, I mean, the player thing kind of sucks, but this is where DVD was. Like, DVD took a couple years before you saw sub-$100 players. I remember spending, like, $250 for my DVD player in 2000 or something like that when I bought mine, so... But I think, yeah, you're right, the discs, when DVD was new and we were buying them, you know, and I was paying... I remember paying $25 or $30 for DVDs, which is kind of what Blu-rays cost right now. The difference was your choice was DVD or VHS, and you weren't going to buy a VHS because DVD was just so much better. And while I really like Blu-ray, it's not... The difference between Blu-ray and DVD is not as significant as the difference between DVD and VHS, right? I mean, we forget DVD offered better picture quality than VHS, but also no rewinding, which is awesome. You could skip scenes, menus, director commentaries. There were tons and tons of other stuff, whereas Blu-ray really only has the better picture and sound quality. It's awesome. For some reason, they decided that there should be this thing where you can, like, hook your Blu-rays up to the internet. They're not really sure. They didn't figure out what to do beyond that. They have this whole thing called Blu-ray Live or Blu-ray Disc Live, something like that. And it's just the stupidest thing on the planet. it's like, okay, I can use on my TV, I can go read the message board for The Dark Knight. That's sweet. I really want to do that. And, like, this is a feature. And it's actually really annoying. It bugged me. Like, when The Dark Knight came out on Blu-ray, it was, you know, like, the first million disc-selling Blu-ray. There's no director commentary on it. So Chris Nolan did a live web commentary. Like, while the movie was running, you tuned in with your internet-enabled Blu-ray player, and it was, like, a text commentary, and he took questions and answered them and stuff. But, like, I was working when that was happening and couldn't watch it. And, like, I've never been able to figure out where you can download it or anything.
Wow.
So I'm just really pissed because I would have loved to have watched the movie with his commentary, and I can't.
Well, I'll tell you what. In about 80 years, what you're going to have is this big movement to restore the live director commentaries of the early 2000s that just people didn't care enough to preserve. But they'll be coming out of some, you know, insane asylum in Puerto Rico, and you'll have it again.
Oh, can we get the commentary from the Criterion Spinal Tap laser?
Well, I would think so.
That's like gone from existence now. That'd be awesome. Well, what do you think of the other big thing is, well, maybe DVD sticks around, but maybe it all becomes moot because we're going to just download stuff. You think that's going to be the way things go?
I don't. And the studios want it to be because it cuts out the middleman. They don't have to pay a big chunk of the revenues to the retail chains, so they would love download, and they're going to try very hard to make it happen. And yes, absolutely, downloads will become a thing for rentals, but I don't see us replacing the physical box that we own. If we own stuff, we'd like to own it. Just as a culture, it feels like a ripoff if you pay $20 for the right to download something whenever you want to.
Yeah.
That's not something that's going to click with our with the American public.
Though, I don't know the last time I bought a music CD, and I buy stuff off iTunes Music Store all the time, so.
But you own it, don't you? I mean, you at least have the file around on your hard drive.
True.
Okay, so maybe I should rephrase. I'm thinking about streaming rather than downloading. So streaming, that's going to be great for rentals. It's not going to be something that you would buy and just have the right to stream it all the time. But even with downloads, I think the difference between movies and music that the studios don't seem to get is music is something that you listen to when you're, you know, out and about.
Yeah.
If you're walking, if you're exercising, if you're driving, if you're just at work, you can listen to music. With a movie, that's something you kick back on the sofa and watch and dedicate your time to. You don't tend to watch movies when you're at other areas of life. You don't watch movies on the road, or at least hopefully you don't. you know, and I can see having the little iPod player for if you're on a subway or something. But for the most part, you don't need movies to be portable, and that makes downloading less of a benefit.
Here's the best trend ever. It's getting the digital copy for Windows Media Player or iTunes or whatever when you buy the DVD set. They started doing this, and it's great. No, it sounds ridiculous, but it's awesome.
How have you made use of that?
It's like you say, if you're on a plane or something, I'm not always bringing like a laptop. I can watch The Dark Knight on my, that's a bad example, but watching The Dark Knight on the iPhone is not that good, by the way. But you know,
you don't appreciate the IMAX cinematography.
Yeah, no, but
what you need is a giant iPod that just looms over you.
True, that'd be awesome. But if I'm watching, I don't know, WALL-E or something like that, that's an okay movie. It works all right. It's much better in a big theater, but I like having the digital copy around. My ultimate dream that is still apparently way far off is just having every movie I own also like on a hard drive somewhere, so I can just call it up without having to go get the disc or sort through it from like different TVs and that kind of stuff.
That would be cool.
It's a real pain, at least for me, to rip DVDs. Like, stuff that I own, like, to try and rip it so I can have it in iTunes or my iPod. I don't know why. You got to deal with encryption and weird non-encryption formats, and I get frustrated and stop doing it. So I do like the digital copies, so maybe that's a nice middle ground for people like me. But, yeah, I'm kind of frustrated by the download services that exist. They don't... I haven't really enjoyed any of them. I've tried, like, Amazon's and Apple's and... I hate the cable company on-demand stuff, which never seems to be very good.
So changing topics once again, I hope you're not getting whiplash here. Hollywood is always remaking things. They come out with a lot of remakes of things that are just ridiculous. You don't remake Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. You don't remake Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. You don't remake The Third Man, which I heard. Have you heard about that? The Third Man remake with Leonardo DiCaprio? And...
I heard a rumor, but I chose not to believe it.
What on earth is all that stuff?
Do they know that post-war Vanna doesn't exist anymore? How are you going to shoot that? Like, they cleaned it up, I think.
Well, CGI, right?
Oh,
cartoons.
Oh boy.
Hey, Gladiator made a really convincing Rome.
Oh, no.
So anyway, there is a good remake that I see. Maybe it's because it's not actually Hollywood doing it, but Zhang Yimou, who is the director of, you know, martial arts movies like Hero, which I think actually is the most beautiful movie I've ever seen. You wouldn't think a martial arts movie would be visually beautiful, but it is gorgeous. It is just wonderful. If you haven't seen Hero, you should. And he made some others like House of Flying Dagger and Curse of the Golden Flower, I think, and basically anything of the anything else. And but he's remaking the Coen brothers' Blood Simple. What is that about?
Oh, man.
Of course, we have to talk about the Coen brothers because I think it's been a couple episodes since we brought them up.
Yeah, a couple minutes.
But Blood Simple, what a neat idea. I mean, that if you want to do a remake, this is how to do it, because you know that he is not going to make just, you know, hey, here's how to recapture the spirit of the original and then fail to do that. Knowing what kind of a filmmaker he is, he's going to inject a totally different tone to the material. But what interesting material to use.
Yeah, it's worth, I mean, you mentioned his martial arts films, but he's also well known for his beautiful kind of period dramas too, which is a weird mix to have.
Yeah, Raise the Red Lantern, which, fascinating movie. I was enthralled beginning to end, but it is very quiet and subdued, and, you know, so it's not the same kind of thing. But Blood Simple is kind of noir thriller kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I've never seen him do.
And I
suppose the story is transplanted to Chinese culture as well, so that'll be interesting just in and of itself.
Here's the IMDb plot summary for it, the remake, which is, the owner of a Chinese noodle shop schemed to murder his adulterous wife and her lover goes awry. So I guess they were able to transplant it from the American South, which... That's the thing about Blood Simple, is it's got such a clear sense of setting. I mean, I remember the setting as much as I remember anything else in the movie, so to just completely transplant it should be very interesting. But it's cool, though, because, of course, the Coens are constantly remaking things in crazy ways, or, like, putting their own spin on older ideas. It's nice to see someone doing it to them.
Yeah, and you mentioned that movie being very closely tied to the American South. Well, it was occurring to me, and I don't think we've talked about it yet, that the Coens might be the most American filmmakers we've got these days. If you think about all their movies, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, I mean, it's even got a state in the title, right? A Hudsucker Proxy is just irrevocably New York, and that whole New York kind of big, fast-paced life vibe. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? One movie after another, No Country for Old Men, it is just so tied. It is unmistakably American, every movie they make. And what's funny is they take on urban areas and rural areas. They do the coast, they do the heartland. I think one of the reasons it's so compelling is they never fall into the trap of glamorizing or just disparaging something. You know, the country folk are never hicks, nor are they living in this idyllic lifestyle away from the hustle and bustle of the city. And, I mean, they're very fair.
True.
And perceptive about what life is like in all these different areas of America. And you know, A Serious Man is, which we still haven't seen, but that's delving into Jewish culture in America.
Yeah.
That's just fascinating that they've been able to capture Americana in the way they have with their filmography.
They do seem to hate L.A., though.
Well,
I mean, The Big Lebowski is an amazing portrait of L.A., but not a favorable one. But that's fair, because L.A. is a terrible place. So I think it's fair to hate it. I mean, everyone who's ever been there hates it. And yeah, I agree. It is weird. And you see the best, most American filmmakers we have right now, possibly ever. I don't know if anyone's ever captured America as well as they do. And you're right, the range is great. And I also like that they capture parts of America that I don't think ever existed. You know, the New York in the Hudsucker Proxy is as much the Hollywood New York of the 30s and 40s as it is.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Any actual New York City. I mean, I obviously wasn't in New York City in the 30s, but I'm going to guess it probably wasn't quite like it is in the Hudsucker Proxy. But it is a wonderful capturing of a time and place that maybe the rest of the country thought existed. I'm sure New Yorkers had a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not the realistic New York City, it is nevertheless one that is imagined and is associated with New York City. So it's real in that sense. It's real in some perception of it.
I guess it's the American perception of New York City. It's what we think of when we think of New York.
Yeah. And exaggerated a bit because it's a comedy, of course, but nevertheless authentic.
Yeah, I like what you say, too, about them not looking down on the characters. In fact, the characters are given interesting speaking patterns and styles and are not just a bunch of dimwit idiots. And boy, how great are the desert shots in Raising Arizona.
Or the snowscapes in Fargo.
I know. And both of those are pretty desolate places. Like, Arizona's a nice place to drive through, but you don't want to spend too much time there. And I'm going to guess the same is true about the Midwest, but they make it seem like just a tremendously fascinating place to be. When in fact, those are mostly empty spaces.
So let's have a new topic, because it's been a couple of minutes. How about the movie Renaissance? Have you seen that, Stephen?
You know, I've only seen pieces of it. It was on cable for a while, and I watched a couple scenes, but I haven't sat down and watched the whole thing yet.
Okay, so I was fascinated by this, and it's worth talking about because it's so unique. This is a movie that is animated, but it is animated in a very realistic style, and yet only black and white. And I don't mean black and white and gray. I mean truly, the colors you see are black and white, and that's it. So you see a lot of silhouettes, shadows over people's faces. There actually is here and there a little bit of gray to represent seeing through glass or, you know, reflections of things. Sometimes some gray would be used to represent those shadings, but for the most part, you only ever get the color solid black or solid white in various textures. So that sounds weird, but it's a perfect complement to the material, which is, it's sort of film noir, also sort of futuristic sci-fi kind of thing, where you have a totalitarian kind of regime where everybody's being watched and there's machinery that controls people's lives and make sure it's all set according to the way the state wants to run things. And it's an action movie, a spy movie, a mystery, all kind of wrapped up into a plot of intrigue. And if it were live action and you saw the movie, it would be good. It would be a good movie on its own. But in this crazy visual style that I've really just never seen in any other movie, it complements it beautifully, and you come away from it with this feeling like you were really in some kind of weird alternate reality. It's just a wonderful creative idea.
You know what the animation style reminds me of? Because they do a lot of the, like, no lines around the characters, so they're made up of, like, negative space, and there's a lot of, like, you know, independent comic books and stuff that have a similar look. The Sin City movie used a similar look at a couple different scenes. They would kind of use, obviously that was live action, so it wasn't animated, but they did some of the crazy super contrast black and white stuff to emulate the Frank Miller pen and ink sketches, or ink and paper kind of things. And actually, have you seen The Spirit?
No.
Which was the movie that Frank Miller directed after he apparently thought he could direct because of Sin City. Frank Miller's the comic book artist. He did Sin City, did a bunch of Batman stuff. Really celebrated comic book artist who went insane a while back, and that doesn't get mentioned enough. he co-directed Sin City, which I love, but I think really that was Robert Rodriguez doing it all, because The Spirit is one of the craziest movies I've ever seen. I can't even begin to describe how strange it is. It's not good. It's pretty far from being good. But it's worth watching just because I've never seen a movie quite like it. It's got the same kind of visual style of Sin City, where they did, you know, all done on green screens with computer-generated backgrounds. It's all black and white, except for some splotches of color. And they do a lot of stuff to make it look animated, even though it never is. But whereas Sin City, you know, kind of exploited well-known archetypes, you know, we got the super tough guy who's falsely accused. We got the good cop up against a corrupt system. The Spirit is never remotely comprehensible. It's about this guy who can't get killed, and he can't get killed because Samuel L. Jackson, who's the bad guy, also can't get killed. And then they're trying to get, like, the blood of Hercules or something like that that will make everyone immortal.
What?
At one point, Samuel L. Jackson comes out dressed up as a Nazi, like in full Nazi uniform. This is never mentioned again, nor does anyone comment on the fact that he's dressed as a Nazi. I don't know if the movie's trying to tell me something. Is that symbolism? Like, Nazis. Like, I guess that's symbolic of what I don't know. And again, the fact that everyone just takes it for granted in the movie that, oh yeah, the bad guy is... He's also Scarlett Johansson, who's his... I guess she's Samuel Jackson's henchman. I'm not sure. I guess I think she's working with him, but maybe she doesn't like him. It wasn't clear. She's also dressed as a Nazi? And I guess so they're Nazis?
You know, if other things are supposed to be symbols of Nazis, not the other way around.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, they're not Nazis, I don't think. It's,
You know what's going to happen? We're going to get about 50 comments from people telling us we're stupid, and obviously this is why they were dressed this way.
If anyone can... I've never... I don't know if anyone's actually tried to figure that movie out, because I think everyone's kind of hated it, but I would actually recommend it if, again, it's not good, but it is weird, and it is weird that he was able to convince a studio to give him the money to make that. Like, did they have a script? I don't know. I think he may have just sketched some stuff. And like, here, look at my drawings. I'm great. Give me money. And then, yeah, when they kind of dumped the movie, yeah. Because I was kind of excited for it. I loved Sin City. I thought, oh, great. Another follow-up might be great. No. But it was weird.
So speaking of follow-ups, when is the Sin City 2 movie coming out?
I don't know.
Because I thought that was all set to go.
I don't know.
Like the day after Sin City opened, or maybe even before that, Rodriguez was like, okay, I'm going to make two more sequels, and I'm making them now.
Yeah.
And they'll be ready in a month.
I don't know. Well, I guess, like, you know, Mickey Rourke got hot again, so I heard that they're having trouble getting him back now.
Oh.
I don't think it's going to happen. Maybe it will, but it'll be like 10 years later, and it'll be terrible.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Oh, well.
Well, I think that wraps up our insane jumping around episode. I guess check us out online at allmovietalk.com. You can go and give us some feedback or comments. Let us know if we missed anything or if there's anything you think we should talk about. If you have topics, want to hear us ramble about something, I think we'd be open to that. And yeah, we might post some other stuff on the website as well. So go check it out, allmovietalk.com.
And also check out rinkworks.com, RANKWORKS, for more entertainment features. So what do we got coming up? Are we committing to another episode after this?
At least one more, I think. We got to do it.
Okay.
We got to do all TV talk.
All TV talk. Steven had convinced me, finally, to do all TV talk. I don't know what that's got to do with movies, but maybe we'll find out next time.